This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
Thank you so much for joining us, to our viewers, or if you're watching, or if you're listening on Podbean or any of the other podcasting platforms. Thank you so much for joining us. And tonight, we're talking about UK politics. And someone emailed me the other day, so we need more UK politics. So here we have Mr. Carl Benjamin on UK politics. Carl, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And we're looking at Boris channels his inner Marxist with high taxes, loss of freedom, diversity. There's a whole long list, but you can only put so many failings in one or two lines. So it could be a long, long list. But actually, Carl, sorry, can I say before we jump into the topic, you've got, John, let us know what's happening with Lotus Eaters. You've got an event coming up. There are some tickets, I think, available one of the nights. Do you want to just give the viewers an update on that?
Yeah, we're doing two live shows in London on the 24th and 25th. That's the Friday and the Saturday of this month, so in about weeks or just over 10 days time, something like that. And the Saturday sold out, but Friday we still have some tickets available, and we've just revealed our special guest, which is Andrew Lawrence, who I'm very thrilled about, because after Andrew Lawrence got cancelled, he was doing like small club tours, and he came to Swindon twice in this period. And me and my wife both went. You like him on the spot, but B, he's really funny as well. And they were both, you know, really good shows. And so I'm really, really chuffed to be able to meet him, because I haven't actually met him yet, so it'll be at the show I meet him. And obviously I'm chuffed to have him with us. But yeah, I'll be looking at, I'll be doing a little presentation on, what's it called? Transgender issues in early life from a Facebook group that I found, and you would not believe some of the things they are discussing in this private Facebook group. For some reason I was allowed into, like, I just clicked join, and it's not very big. It's only 10,000 people or something like that, but I clicked join, and I've just sat in there silently, because anyone who dissents from what the orthodoxy is just gets booted like that. You know, how dare you say something negative? And so I'm just gonna, you know, grab a few things, blur out the names, and we'll talk about the way that they think in this group. And this is something that's kind of reflective of the social justice atmosphere in places like the Tavistock Center and stuff like that. They're weird and culty.
Sounds good. The last time I saw you in a live event, you were talking about, was it, what was the chap? Gamal? Some love story that you and Dank did.
I can't remember offhand. It's been, well, you know, COVID, we're stuck inside, you know, not allowed to do anything. But yeah, so you can go to lotusseeds.com, grab tickets for that. It's on the front page, and see us there, because it'll be good fun. It'll be a really good laugh.
Sounds good. Well, let's jump in. Just one thing to our viewers, if please do like and share, put it subscribe. And also, it's let us know your feedback on, did a video yesterday trying to do short info videos. So did one on the big pharma raking in the money from COVID vaccines, and the top five vaccine companies are actually, they expect to make sales by the end of next year of $500 billion. That's just five of them. $560 billion or so by the end of next year. So do have a look at that. Good to know your thoughts. Drop us an email, info@heartsofoak.org. And we've got about another 20 different topics, just trying to do 5-minute videos on these things. And hopefully we'll do a cheerier one and not want to make your blood boil like that one. Your taxpayers' money. Carl, we're going to look at the Tory party. The Tory party is what, nearly 200 years old, back from Peel's day. And it, I think one of the lines that Robert Peel had down was that he saw, that he opposed what he saw as unnecessary change, fearing a perpetual vortex of agitation, all about stability, tradition. And again, we have law and order, entrepreneurship. We have all different ideas that the Conservative Party, I guess in the UK and abroad, are known for. Let me just go through some of their election slogans I was looking through, and we can blast from the past. So Get Brexit Done was obviously Dominic Cummings' great one from 2019. Forward Together, or maybe Strong and Stable, was 2017.
Well, hang on, so can we critique these very quickly as we go? Because I don't want to forget any, right? So got to give them credit on Brexit. Brexit, fairly done. Yeah. I'm fairly happy with it.
Yeah.
Good. One important thing I think to remember about Brexit is it wasn't just about leaving the European Union. And we can tell this from the Lord Ashcroft polling. So yeah, I want control on every leave category. Yeah. Each group of people that was polled, I want control of the UK's business within the UK. And we want sovereignty. But the next one was then immigration. And what was the third one on the list? I can't remember offhand. But there were other concerns that were packaged into that. And you can see what they're saying, really. They're saying Tony Blair, and they're not saying this explicitly, but this is implicit in, I think, what was in it. Tony Blair tried to Europeanize Britain, and we don't want that. We want a British Britain. We're not the same as those people on the continent. And, you know, not judgment. It's just, you know, just differences. That's all. You know, we don't want the same things. And what people want, I think, is a kind of restoration of a Britishness about the country. And it's frustrating. That's that issue. Making money and fulfilling Tony Blair's legacy. It's like, God damn it. You know, you've got such a mandate. You know, you could do anything under the rubric of Brexit, I think, really.
No, exactly. I think Boris needs to take back control from Kerry. That's what he needs to do. That's his main thing.
But I've got nothing to substantiate it. You know, I can't prove it. But, right. I mean, you know, let's be real, right?
So 2017, strong and stable. And I don't know if that's happened. It's more bumbling and chaotic.
Let me reset my internet a second.
Yeah, go for that. Right, call reset. We'll go down. So I'll read them down for you, and then we'll go back on them. So we have 2015, strong leadership, a brighter, more secure future. 2010 was vote for change. 2005, I think, was also vote for change. So it wasn't much change there.
I think I'm back. So what was 2017 again? Sorry.
So 2017, strong and stable, Theresa May. I think your laugh gives it away.
That's just good. I mean, that's just good comedy. I mean, Christ, you know, what a disaster, mate, in retrospect.
Completely. I think my older boy at school, he used to come home and they used to have strong and stable jokes. And these were, 9-year-olds. They thought this was just taking the piss.
What an absolute comedy.
2015, strong leadership or a brighter, more secure future. That was Cameron.
I can't believe any of these won, but they all, I mean, I suppose the Get Brexit Done one makes sense, but the rest of them are just weak as piss. God, the Labour Party must have been so embarrassingly bad.
I didn't even look at what Labour Party, but so 2010, vote for change. 2005.
Was yes. That, hang on. Vote 2010, for vote for change. What a conservative slogan that is.
I know. It's an oxymoron. I know.
It's embarrassing.
And that 2005 was vote for change as well. So they actually stuck with the same change slogan. 2005 didn't work, so they tried 2010. 2001, time for common sense, which obviously we're still looking for that.
God. I can see why Tony Blair was trouncing them at this point.
Actually, when I look back, the only two that I could see that really, really resonated and that you still remember now is 1997, New Labour, New Danger, which was Blair with the devil eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, that you remember that.
Didn't work, you know? Yeah. Well, this was really when I, you know, I was about, 17, something like that. So I wasn't really paying attention to politics at that age. But the thing is, looking back now, that's not a good slogan, is it? Because in negative adversarial slogans rarely speak to your own intentions. And in the implication of is just that you're kind of bitter and envious, right?
Yeah.
You're not saying anything positive and you know, forward facing of your own. I don't think those slogans work.
The 1997 was 1997, 1979, which got Margaret Thatcher in, was Labour isn't working. No, that's true. But the, do you remember the iconic picture of the long queues, the unemployment queues? Yeah. And that did stick, that people thought, yes, actually, it isn't working, and they voted for. So to me, that's one that really sticks in your mind. And there are other
slogans. An adversarial slogan. Because, I mean, my dad has been a lifelong Conservative voter, apart from when I was in UKIP, and he voted UKIP because he's a good lad. My dad has been a lifelong Conservative voter because of what the Labour Party did. And he comes from working-class Wiltshire. You know, he's not like he comes from Eton or something. But 4-day working weeks, kind of rubbish piling up in the streets. You can't have intermittent electricity as if we're some third world country. It was obvious that the Labour Party was ruining the country. So it's probably a very easy slogan to, you know, Labour isn't working. Yeah, you can see that's true. It's demonstrable.
But when have they ever, you know? One of the other big things I remember in 2019, it was get Brexit done. That was a big push. But the other one was vote for us because you don't want Labour. And Corbyn was the danger to society. He would turn us into a communist state. And it was, actually, we don't offer anything as Tories, but actually you don't want them, so you better vote for us. So it was really, get Brexit done was a positive message, but you had the fear message of Corbyn.
I mean, in their defense, they were probably right about Corbyn. In the defense of the voters, nobody thought Boris was going to become Corbyn. So, you know. Yeah. Who saw that coming? I mean, I really didn't think he was just going to literally adopt the Labour platform and go back on all of these Conservative manifesto pledges. I mean, don't get me wrong, I don't hold much weight in a political pledge, but not raising taxes, and you're the Conservative Party, Labour Party is literally demanding tax rises, and you say, we're not going to raise taxes, and that seems like a pretty easy win, and then to go back on that, it's like, why? And I saw lots of chatter about this. And one of the funny things I found about this was people saying, well, hang on, Boris is outflanking the Labour Party from the left. And it's like, yeah, why? Why would anyone do that? Because this is a ridiculous proposition, right? We've just absolutely trounced our opposition by saying we're going to do what I think we could call the conservative thing, which is making sure that Britain has sovereignty. And we annihilated them. In like record-breaking numbers, numbers that have just not been emulated before, and like entire constituencies of Labour that have just never voted Conservative are suddenly voting for Boris. It's like, yeah, so I'm going to adopt the failed policies of the opposition to win who? What are you trying to win? You've won. You know, now take the victory, remake the country, fix the problems. It's really not that challenging, I would have thought. But I mean, I don't know what dark forces have their fingers controlling the Conservative Party. You know, I'm an outsider. I look at it and go, well, if it were me, everything could go hang and I'd be able to fix a lot of the problems. But it's not me, sad to say, I suppose. So I guess we just have to assume that, you know, the deal that they made with the devil is being paid off or something. Who knows?
At least Corbyn stood for something. I kind of missed that.
Yeah. And well, hang on. So I hate to have to defend Boris, right? But I actually think Boris does. I think in his heart, I think he does. I think he is a patriot. I just think, you know, the problem is the rest of him that's made of jelly. And, you know, he's got no spine, no backbone. He's probably controlled by Carrie. He seems to have weak people around him who don't seem to have the stones to just turn around and say, Boris, look, it's just not what we're doing. We're not raising taxes. What we're going to do is cut all these programs that the Labour Party have introduced. We're going to get rid of, you know, all of these equalities ministers and culture ministers and all these nonsense. Nothing to do with what a conservative state should be like. Nothing at all. We're going to stop just doling out millions of pounds to basically, I don't want to say like, you know, slovenly, lazy people who are just going to sit on welfare, but that's what it is. Yeah, stop giving them money. Stop all of this. Stop giving money to third world countries who hate us. Stop ruining the economy with things like mass immigration and various other idiotic programs that we have, and just put the country back on the sort of footing where it's from the bottom up, right? So the regular person gets their taxes lowered. They can make money. They can start the businesses and earn money. They'll spend it in the economy, and you know the economy will generally rise on the common sense of the regular person, as we've always done it in this country. And it's always worked as well.
Obviously, it the name gives it away. Conservatives, they're supposed to conserve. They're supposed to hold on to what is traditional in the country, what makes Britain, Britain, what makes England, England, to hold on to those values, the foundational principles which make the society. And that hasn't happened under successive conservative governments. And one reason which we may disagree on this one, but one reason why I said I will never vote or never support the Tories again was when Cameron promised just before the 2010, I think it was, whenever gay marriage wouldn't be introduced. And then he went and introduced it. And again, that's an example. There are many, many examples of how the Conservatives have completely failed to hold on to any values or culture which the UK has.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the Conservative Party for a long time now, because they're a very strange beast, aren't they? They're weirdly trapped between two worlds, possibly even three, and they aren't sure what they're supposed to be. You know, like there's the sort of old sort of traditional conservatives, then you've got the sort of Whigs, and then you've got the progressive conservatives who have the pride flag, but not the new pride flag, you know, with the traditional pride flag. And I find it very interesting, because I think that there is definitely a place for what I guess we call liberal conservatism, right? Because the sort of old Whigs who have got the negotiation of power between the state and the individual correct, as in we have constitutions, the state's job is to manage the country in abstract, you know, make sure the police operate, make sure that, you know, the civil service functions, make sure that diplomacy with other countries happens, you know, collect taxes as low as they can be for the interest of the regular person. And then that's the sort of political philosophy that the Conservatives should have, right? The sort of minimalistic night watchman, classically liberal state. And that's a natural outgrowth of English life, and it is particularly English in many ways. And that's right. You know, we all agree, actually, yeah, the government should essentially be over there. You know, it's someone else's problem. And if I want to go and engage with the government, then I'll walk myself down to Westminster and go and protest. But in the meantime, I'll pay my taxes, you leave me alone, and we'll all be happy to manage our own lives. And then you can see the separation into the sort of, I guess we'll call the social conservatism, the sort of the deep, thick sort of relational life of people, you know. So, you know, what you do with your families and your friends and your local area and your small clubs, and the sort of you know, the way that Scruton would talk about the clubbable instinct of the British. So leave us alone to live our lives, basically, and be happy, and we'll start our businesses and all this sort of stuff, and all these things that don't really require much government oversight at all. I mean, I recently started a business and I didn't have to talk to the government about it at all. But if you're in Germany, it's completely different. You actually have to do this. You know, if you want to buy a house, you've got to consult the local police and things like this. Oh my God. But, and so it's very, very different. And these two instincts are natural partners in the Conservative Party these days, and should be. I mean, it used to be that the Whigs were on the outside of the Conservative Party, and then progress carried on. But now it's come that I guess we could just call it the progressive Blairite faction that I suppose was represented by Anna Soubry and that sort of type before they got kind of yeeted out by Brexit.
The traitors. Sounds super.
We can call them traitors if you like, because I think that's a fair description. But that sort of instinct, like, you could see that Cameron was trying to struggle against it, but didn't know how, right? Because I remember him giving a speech about muscular liberalism, and that is actually what I'm describing, where you've got the sort of liberal state that protects our rights, and then the rest of it is down to us, the people. So we should have charity, you know, we should have social initiatives that we voluntarily engage with. And this is why when they're like, oh no, food banks are a good thing, and the Labour Party are hammering them out, how could you say that? It's like, no, because that, you can make a really strong argument for, look, that's actually the best of British values, being like, look, people aren't going to starve because we're going to help them. We don't need the government to do this. And in fact, you know, if you want something done, is really the first place you go, the government, really? You go in there for competence, are you? You know, we can return to a sort of, you know, strong society that actually, you know, what Cameron was saying, the big society that does it themselves. He knew what he was trying to say. It's just like all of the Conservatives, they've got about as much, you know, depth as a puddle. And so they'll understand that there is something there they're supposed to do, but they have no real comprehension of how it works and how to resist the Labour Party just battering them every time. Oh, how could you? How could you? You know, we were nearly at utopia. And I think that's the problem is actually too much commitment to liberalism. Now, and I don't mean in the sort of way that we have just described it as the negotiation with the state. Yeah. That should obviously be as it is. But there's a kind of, you know, social liberalism, should we call it, where we're applying rational enlightenment values to things that are irrational. You know, our relationships, our place, and our friends, our family. All those things that we didn't reason ourselves into, we shouldn't really be using reason to manage, because these are all emotional. You know, how you feel about your wife, you know, the magic of spending time with your kids, none of this is reasoned, you know, and it shouldn't be reasoned. And so we don't really want some bureaucrat from the state being like, right, I'm going to apply, you know, my own internal logic to this. Like, yeah, but I've got my logic and I don't need yours at all, you know. And so they end up arriving at the position where basically the state is the arbiter of everything, and it should be done through cold calculation rather than a kind of heartwarmingness. You know, like, I mean, I can remember in my youth, this country had a different feel to it. And now I can't substantiate this scientifically or anything like that, but you remember it just felt more homely, right? It felt like you were more at home and you could go anywhere. You know, I lived all around sort of the south of England. And everywhere we lived, because my dad was in the forces, so every 3 years we'd move. You know, I was born in Aldershot, my sister was born in Ipswich, then we moved to Germany, then we moved back to Huntingdon, I think it was. But wherever I went, I had this kind of homely feel about it, and because it was all normal. You know, it was the product of just people getting on with their lives. It wasn't like bureaucrats or, you know, the managerial elite being like, right, we're going to construct this, you know, this there and that there. And, you know, it all sprung up holistically. And that is the sort of thing that I think the Conservatives should be aiming to recreate or allow to flourish. And to do that, I think they have to essentially undo a lot of what Tony Blair did, because Tony Blair had a commitment to this kind of managerial elite liberalism, this kind of social liberalism. It's like, well, actually, what we can do is have everyone dependent on the state and atomized from one another. You know, notice that everything about the Labour policies is essentially the consequence, if it's not explicitly designed to do this, the consequence is to remove us from one another. You know, have speech policing, have community policing. You know, oh, you can't say that about those people. Why not? Why the hell can't I? Well, they might be offended. Yes, that's why I'm saying it. You know, and I want them to stop whatever they're doing. And that could be your neighbor, that could be whoever, you know, blah, blah, blah. But eventually we'll all end up essentially in these tiny little boxes where no one's allowed to really talk to one another without using this incredibly sanitized language. And I just loathe that. That's not the country I wanted to exist in. And I don't want my kids growing up in that. And the Conservatives really do have that mandate, but they've got to start leaning back into the sort of socially conservative view. And I do think that's based in these sort of deep relationships, but I don't think they understand that. And Cameron definitely didn't understand that. He wanted the consequence of it, because the reason these relationships are important is because this is what drives people to be charitable. You know, because every day they'll say, hello, Mrs. McGregor, hello, Mr. Jones, you know, and they'll walk past and, you know, oh, suddenly that person's fallen on hard times. Well, hell, we're all going to have a whip round. We're all going to chip in, because we don't want, you know, Mrs. Jones losing her house because Mr. Jones has died and she can't pay the mortgage anymore or something like that. That's the sort of thing that like a sort of socially conservative society would do. You know, it actually would look after one another because they know one another. They care about one another. But the way the Labour Party is committed to this total atomic civilization, that can never happen, and that will never happen. And all you'll get is, especially with the advent of mass immigration and multiculturalism, is you will get communities who are like that. You know, the Muslim community is very much like that. They do a lot of charity internally, but no one else does, because everyone else is essentially, oh god, you know, I'll just keep to myself, because it's just easier. Who wants trouble, you know? And so, yeah, basically we're in a position where a lot needs to be done, and the Conservatives just aren't. They're the only option we've got. They're the only option we've got, and they're not going to do it.
And there was I think Trump made in one of the interviews, I think it was on Hannity the other week, and he talked about by 2024, there may not be an America left. And I'm wondering if we look at the UK, or you're maybe more focused on England, actually, will we get to the point where there's actually nothing left for the Conservative Party to conserve or hold on to, because it's gone, it's changed so much. I mean, take out London, which is an international city, so that's separate. The rest of the country, it may not be any need to have the Conservatives around, because there's nothing to conserve any longer.
So I've been thinking about this a lot, because I think that in the next 50 or so years, there won't be a United Kingdom.
Mm.
I think that Tony Blair's devolved parliaments and the one-sidedness of these devolved parliaments, yep. the English parliament is Westminster. So, I mean, if you're going to start a new parliament, what do? You start in Winchester, where Alfred the Great was? You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, I actually wouldn't mind that, you know, being a Wessex boy myself. But, like, you know, like, it doesn't make sense to have these devolved parliaments because we have a great deal of devolution in the country anyway. There's a lot of local management of affairs all over the country, you know, and always has been. And so, like, to give them these separate parliaments has just been a sort of halfway house between being part of the United Kingdom or being a sovereign state. And this, what has this done? This has done the same sort of thing as the European Parliament, where the European Parliament, the British public would just vote UKIP over there, you know, in droves. You know, UKIP was incredibly successful, but they weren't successful domestically, right? Because they were like, yeah, we want you to go and give the foreigners a piece of our mind, obviously, but we will have the Conservatives governing things because that's how we view things should be properly done. And so the devolved parliaments, as you can see, has just been a hotbed of separatism and just this, which is exactly like Brexit was, incidentally. You know, what the European Parliament did for us has probably got us Brexit. If that didn't really have the sort of legislative body, then no one would have noticed, you know, no one would have cared. They probably could have just carried on by executive fiat and forever, and we wouldn't have noticed. So it's, you know, to our benefit. But these parliaments have to go, or the United Kingdom is going to go. Now, it could well be that that's inevitable. And I'm not saying I want the breakup of the United Kingdom, but I have to be honest about what I think might happen. And I think it's important to remember that Britain was formed as an imperial project. As in the English had formed an international empire, the Scots were trying to form an international empire and had failed. And in the course of like about 150 years or so, the monarchies had basically become intertwined. And so you had like an English, you had a Scottish king on the English throne and things like this just through heredity. And this was essentially Scotland's way of kind of buying into an empire, getting access to markets they had failed to gain access to on their own. And so it made this project a very cohesive and valuable one to all partners involved. Well, the empire's gone. The imperial project's over. And I think we can actually say it concluded well. You know, it concluded nobly. You know, we lost the empire defeating the Nazis. Okay, great. We can you know, hang our hats up on that and say, yeah, we're proud of that. And if they want separation, which large portions of the Celtic world seems to, it's not what I want. And, you know, I can't imagine that Wales would actually become independent of England because it's been an organ of England for like 800 years, something like that. You know, I'd be surprised if Northern Ireland wanted the same thing as well, to be honest. But what we're talking about really is Scotland. So, you know, okay. If they want that, then I don't want to deny them that. I don't want to be the guy who says, no, you can't have sovereignty when I've been browbeating about sovereignty for years, right? It would feel deeply hypocritical. And that's a choice that, in my opinion, the Scots have to make, because let's be fair, if the English made it for them, they'd have been kicked out yesterday. So, you know, this is something they have to make themselves. But is that the end of the world if that happens? You know, because we've grown up in the paradigm of Britain, post-war Britain. And it's so to us, it seems really strange. But actually, if you think about it, it would allow us to focus the conversation if, say, England were to return to being the Kingdom of England and Wales. We'd actually be able to change the paradigm slightly. And then, because I think one thing that we all can agree on, no matter what constituent nation we're in, is that England is in bloody sorry shape at the moment. Like, the English don't know who they are, they don't know what they stand for, they don't know what's going on in their country, and they don't know why it continues to go on. And they don't seem to be able to have any kind of conversation with themselves about it because of political correctness and various actual hate speech laws preventing it. And so no one really knows what to do. And if we at least had a sort of commitments to an English identity, like, as Scruton says, the sort of national unifying identity that speaks of the place in which we live rather than like bloodlines or something like that, then maybe we would be able to change the tenor of the conversation or something. I mean, I'm not saying I'm confident that would happen, but maybe it would at least open a door or something, because the paradigm we're currently trapped in is really bizarre. Look at what was the woman who recently won the US women's tennis tournament, right? I don't follow sport. Emma Raducanu or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting how, like, right, okay, she was 2 years old when she got here, born and raised in London. Well, raised in London from 2 years old onwards. So she's British, right? We agree that she's British. But notice that, look at Sadiq Khan. Oh, look, she's Chinese and Romanian and Canadian. It's like, okay, so she's not British then. Is that what you're saying? You know, she's anything but English. You know, she's not like from here. And Sadiq Khan is the first person to point that out. Now, I wouldn't tell her she's not from here. She's obviously from here. You know, you grow up from 2 years old in the country. Mm. You're from that country. You don't know anything about any other countries, right? So I'm not the one saying that. But that's Sadiq Khan's first thought. And it's like, right, okay, well, then we have really thick, deep conversations to talk about there. And, you know, I don't see them ever being resolved in the current paradigm that we're in. So if the union were to peacefully dissolve, then that would at least change the angle. Because then suddenly we'd be able to say, well, hang on a second. If we're in a place, where are we? Well, we're in England, not the United Kingdom anymore. It's the Kingdom of England. Okay, well, who lives in the Kingdom of England? And it's not like, you know, Chinese Romanians. Like, it's not what you expect, right? And it's not to say they can't live here, obviously. You know, I'm not saying anything of the sort. But there is at least an admission there that the English are a people that exist in a place, right? And that's real, and that's fair to acknowledge. And at the moment, well, with the existence of Britain, it can't really be acknowledged. You know, no one wants to say it. And I think that is what has allowed England to fall into this sorry state. Because, I mean, if you just look, like the next census, is, I keep saying this, whenever it comes out, it's going to be a bombshell. It's going to be an absolute bombshell. It's going to find that the biggest, like, three or four cities in England are just not English cities anymore. How long can that go on for? How long can that go on for? And so we have to be able to assert some sort of moral claim to the English have to be able to assert a moral claim to England. And that's not to say that, oh, that means all foreigners are bad or anything like that. It's nothing of the sort. But what it is to say is that when the foreigners are making claims on England, the English can make a counterclaim and say, well, that's a fair claim, fair ask, but we also have a fair ask that we can make. Yeah. And at the moment, that's just prevented outright. And that's not fair. You know, it's not fair to load the scales in the same way that Tony Blair did with the parliaments. It's not fair to load the scales. It's not to say that the foreign people who have arrived here don't have a moral claim or anything that they do. We invited them in. We allowed them to come in. We allowed them to purchase houses and get jobs and join our communities. They have a claim. But the people who they've joined also have a claim, and this balance has to be restored. Otherwise, things are going to get worse and people are going to get angrier, and I dread to think what the consequence of that is. So we can head that off at the post by just admitting that maybe someone has to, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do.
And again, one of the reasons for the Conservative Party has been to promote a strong sense of identity and patriotism, and Labour obviously are embarrassed to be here, as you point out, can.
Sorry to interrupt there. Right? Did you see Jeremy Corbyn protesting the Liverpool Arms Fair? Did you see his protest?
No, recently. No.
Very recently, right? There's a picture going around from behind him of the crowd. How many British flags do you think were in that crowd?
Probably more Palestinian flags.
100%. There were dozens of Palestinian flags, zero British flags. And so there you go. There's Jeremy Corbyn's constituency. Foreigners, whoever's outside of the country or thinks about people outside of the country, that's his constituency. Not an ounce of patriotism in them.
But with the diversity training, until that is torn up and until you go back to looking at what makes Britain great, what focuses on this nation and the benefits, then again, you need a leader who is actually patriotic. And it's been a while since we actually had that.
Well, again, I think underneath all of the jelly, Boris is a patriot. I think he is. You know, like I remember in 2009 or something like that, he was trying to reform the English flag. He was trying to reclaim it because for some reason, again, wouldn't that be the most hilarious thing in the world, right? And again, I'm not asking for this, but if and when Britain were to end as a political entity, well, what's the flag that England's going to fly?
Yeah.
You know, when we're back to the Kingdom of England, we have a flag. We don't fly the British flag. It's just going to be the English flag. The British flag won't exist anymore. It won't represent a political entity. And so now all of those people who hate Britain or hate England and all that, and, you know, it will have to be done under the banner of England. So that will force them to have a conversation and deal with their hatred of the English. And there is a deep amount of hatred of the English. Mm. And I think, in fact, because you were saying about the Conservatives, would they be necessary? I was thinking about this. I don't think that you can stop the Conservatives existing. I think the Conservatives are a genuine expression of the English self-identity, right? And they, because they essentially, they don't, people don't really care that, like, Boris, you know, had got his, you know, number 10 down the street done over by a donor or whatever, you know, $50,000. Oh, wow, that's the corruption, is it? $50,000. Don't care, right? As long as they're not taxing me more, you know, as long as they're not ruining the countryside or something like that. But they are, you know, they actually are doing all of these things, and that's why it matters. And I do wonder how much the Welsh and Scottish, not all of them, obviously, but a large portion of them, view the Conservative Party as the English Conservatives. Hmm. And I think a lot of them do. Because if you look at, like, where the Conservatives succeed, it seems to be in more anglicised areas of Scotland and Wales that they do well in, and less well in the more sort of Celtic nationalist areas, obviously. Hmm. And I wonder how much they subconsciously, if not overtly, think of them as being an English party and not like a party of the United Kingdom. Not that they are, you know, they were a product of the United Kingdom. You know, say 200 years old, the Union's 300 years old, they're a product of the Union. But I do wonder about that, and I don't have any answers or anything. I'm not trying to throw shade or anything like that. It's just, you know, I think these are realities we need to speak to. That's all.
You mentioned taxes. Let's change tack a little bit and look at that. The Conservatives have always been, traditionally, always been the party of low taxes, and it's Labour who is tax and spend, where the Conservatives have always been to live within your means. And public finance, I guess, money comes from economic growth as opposed to high taxes. But again, Boris has torn that up. We've now got the highest tax take for 70 years. And again, what is, if the Tories aren't going to leave you alone, if they're going to come after you and take even more of your money than the Socialists, than Labour, then I get why vote for the Conservatives if they're just after Keir Starmer your money?
Voting and they don't even against
spend
tax
the money
rises.
Wisely.
I know. No, you're absolutely right. Like, it just maddens me that it's Keir Starmer voting against the tax rises. It's like, what is going on here? Well, this is backwards. Absolutely balmy. What are the Conservatives doing? And notice that they dipped below Labour in the polls recently.
Yeah.
You know, the Labour Party went up to 35%, Conservative went down to 33%. And they must have been thinking, wait, what are we doing? It's like, yeah, but we didn't vote Labour. Nobody voted Labour. You know, like, it's a very tiny number. Like, in the North, the word lefty has become a slur. Oh, he's a lefty. Oh, don't go near him, but with a Northern accent that I'm not going to try and imitate. And, you know, like, rightfully so, frankly, obviously, you know, anyone who is a patriot of any form, even if it's just your local area, don't vote Labour. They'll ruin everything you have because they've got big ideas that never pan out. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what we can do. I've been reduced to saying, look, email your local MP. Just email your local Conservative MP, because they do pay attention to the emails that they get, right? People think, oh, they'll never listen, but this is the one thing they actually do. You've got to email your particular constituent MP. You can't pick one that you like and email them. You've got to do your own one. But just send them a strongly worded letter, and enough of these letters will make them think, hang on, especially if they see themselves going down in the polls. If there's one thing the Conservatives can do, it's preserve their arses. And they've got to think that what they're doing is electoral suicide. They have to think that. And they have to know that this is, you know, look, the public are wide awake and are watching them and know what they're doing and are not happy. And so you have to write your letters. It's very boring. It's not very exciting. It doesn't have to be a long letter. And I said, my local MP is North Wiltshire's James Gray. Now, James Gray is very, very good in most things. He is a Brexiteer. He is a social conservative. He doesn't want the country flooded with immigrants. He's generally very good. But what's he done? You don't know who he is. Yeah. He should be on TV every day going, why are we doing Labour policies? Why are the Labour Party this? And so I basically sent him a very, very shitty email going, do something. It was just titled, do something. Get doing something. Make the left howl about what you guys are doing. Fix things. And I mean, I didn't get a response because I wasn't really expecting one, because I was just angry, and I just was like, right, that's it. I'm going to do it. But basically, you should do the same thing. The more angry and sternly worded emails they get, the more they're going to be like, okay, we're going down the wrong path, especially if that correlates with their polling, which it is at the moment. So basically, we have to start mounting pressure, because, like I said, people are like, oh, we need, like, Peter, dude, it's 200 years old. It's going to outlast tell us everything, because really I think it is just a reflection of our collective psyche. Yeah. You know, so we have to start bullying it, basically. You have to start telling them, look, do this or else, you know. And that's, I think, the only way to enact any kind of reasonable change, frankly.
I actually think Keir Starmer might be Labour's secret weapon, because Labour voters will put a red rosette on a pig and they'll vote for them. The Conservatives, you can't make any Conservative voter angry at Keir Starmer because he just, bleh. So won't really come out. And there's no danger like there was with Corbyn. It's Keir Starmer. What does Keir Starmer stand for? Nothing. Well, what's the problem then? So he could be their secret weapon.
I mean, maybe. I mean, one of the things that's just so frustrating, though, is that up at the last couple of years, essentially all the Conservatives had to do is stand still to win because of what the Labour Party's become. And Keir Starmer, because Boris has taken up Corbyn's torch of, you know, wealth redistribution, Keir Starmer's just standing still, and he's starting to win now. You know, it's like a race to the bottom. And if that one just stops, they start winning because the other one just keeps going down. And it's like, oh, God, you know, one day someone's going to figure out, wait, if we actually just do something positive, we'll start going up. You know, we'll actually start gaining something at the end of this. But, oh, God, who knows? Who knows? I don't. I mean, I don't really have anything to say about Keir Starmer, because what would you say about him?
Nothing to say.
No. Yeah. He's just, you know, like a very boring version of Tony Blair.
Today, Priti Patel, who we all had great hopes for, I think, and I'm now giving up. Others may still be on the fence. She was obviously in Kent on the coast, watching as hordes come over on the legal immigration side. And I think Sky News actually had a helicopter, and they were watching the people coming in. And I think the figures I saw today were 2018, something like 500-600 came over on boats. 2019, it was around 2,500-3,000. Then 2020, it was about 7,000-8,000, and so far it's around 13. So again, all
this year alone is 13.
It's and the information is out there, the news is out there. It's been, if I was a Conservative MP, I would be jumping up and down and say, this has to stop. We need to protect our borders. We need to defend ourselves. And yet there's nothing. So Priti Patel was down as the border control boat to learn how to turn a boat around and push it back. It's quite simple. But they've got a whole training exercise for this now.
See, as I understand it, it's the product of treaties that we have with the Europeans that is preventing us from taking any meaningful action on this, and probably a great deal of internal resistance in the Home Office itself. I mean, I genuinely do think that Priti Patel does want to do something about this. I mean, I don't think you bully Sir Philip Putnam out of his job if you're not trying to do something, right? And, you know, keep bullying them all out of their jobs, Priti. In fact, start firing them if they're getting in the way. But again, Scruton has a great line on this where he's like, look, treaties are like religious texts, right? Like it's a dead hand that reigns over you for generations and generations that can't be modified unless it's repealed entirely. And so it's actually quite a difficult thing to work with within the legal framework. So I actually am vaguely sympathetic to the fact that these things are happening and they don't really know what to do because they are bound in certain ways by things they didn't themselves create. But then you've got the majority. Get rid of it if you have to. You know, get rid of, do something drastic if you have to. And at the end of the day, like, I don't think that, you know, paying Rwanda to process them and house them or whatever, the Danes are being just as brutal with it. You know, it's like, no, you know, you're not coming. Don't, you know, just put big billboard out, you know, pay for adverts in France. If you illegally come to Britain, we're going to send you somewhere terrible. And we're just going to leave you there forever. We'll pay for you to be there and not in Britain. You know, be belligerent about it. Do not come. You know, the message should be very clear. To hotels or something? No, you take them to, like, you know, unused army barracks, and then you take them to wherever you want them to be processed, you know, and you make sure it's a swift process. You don't just let them lounge there. You don't let them leave. They're illegal criminals. They're illegal. They've committed a crime by crossing into this country. So you treat them as if they've committed a goddamn crime. You know, don't treat them as if, oh, well done, you've just arrived. Fantastic. You know, no, I absolutely despise it. You know, and the thing is, right, and this is the thing that really bugs me. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they think they're going to be like 20,000 this year, and it's like, yeah, wow, that's bad. That's really bad. We're going to have 300,000 legal coming in net this year. 600,000. Okay. So that 20,000 is just a drop in the bucket. And I'm telling you, man, you can see it here. You can see it here. 3 or 4 years ago, before COVID, like Swindon was just a normal English town. It had a small, you know, it was called Manchester Road. That was where there was significant immigration. It was an immigrant area. But most of it was just normal. And I tell you, man, you walk down the high street now, and it's just like being in London. Ethnic group or anything. It's just all these different people from all over the world. And just thinking, why are you here? You know, why are you here? And the answer, of course, is money. You know, the answer is that they think they're going to make money here. And as soon as means the wherever they came from, which is what happened in Brexit. You know, literally, there was 130,000 of them sort of thing left or something in a year. It's like, okay. That's good. You know, these people will go home because they're here for mercenary reasons. They're not here because of a love of the country. And the thing is, I would like the ones who did come with a love of the country to stay. You know, if you love this country and you want to, you know, have a little piece of it yourself and, you know, integrate into the local area, then great. You know, no one's going to complain about that. That's positive. But it's not that for most of them. And everyone can admit this. You know, that's the fact. And if it was the case, you wouldn't have an outflow of 250,000 immigrants. Like, they wouldn't leave after being here for a number of years, right? They would stay. And so you can tell that this is not the driving, it's not love of the country that's the driving motivation. It's not the desire to become British and integrate. And so why do we allow them in the first place? But, you know, I don't know why the Conservatives want closed borders. Who knows? But, I mean, one theory that came up recently, actually, my social media manager, Ramveer, he pointed this out to me. The Conservatives, 20% of their funding comes from property development. Now that explains why every day in the Southwest we see in, you know, some local town, oh, they're building 500 new houses over these fields. And obviously people are like, well, why are you building over our green spaces? Why are you building over our green spaces? And they've got to the point where they're like, oh, well, we're going to start building over the green belts and things like this. And why? Because the Conservatives are being paid to do it. That's why. And this is something that just has to stop. And I would have thought that the one issue that could unite literally every faction in the country, from the most watermelon green to the most staunch, you know, right-wing conservative, is the countryside should be protected because it's our heritage. It's our patrimony. It's what we enjoy on a daily basis. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. People don't realize the connection that the Brits have to their countryside because their countryside is safe. There's nothing out there that's going to hurt you. And moreover, it's not even rugged landscape. You know, if it was like the Sahara Desert or something, you know, you're not going to go for a walk in the desert. You know, you're not going out there because it's dangerous. But no, that's not what the British countryside like. British countryside is lovely. It's pleasant. And it's like an extension of our own back gardens. And that's how everyone treats it, you know. And you walk past, you see these people, you know, you smile and you nod. You know, they're walking their dogs or the kids or whatever. They're going for a run. And it's something that we all want to keep because it's good for everyone. And allowing people to continue building things, they're either building them directly for people who've just moved here. Why? Why are we housing the third world, the entire world, in our countryside that we need? Or it's people who are essentially refugees from the cities who are like, well, I couldn't stand living in the cities anymore, so you're going to have to build me houses out in the countryside. It's like, no. How about we just stop people moving here? You know, the population growth of this country, there's something like 87% of the population growth is immigration. Therefore, if we, and this is the easiest thing. So we know there's a net outflow of like 200,000 people a year, 175,000, something like that, with 80,000 Brits or so, 170,000 foreigners. And we have a net inflow of 650,000, and 87% of the population growth is due to immigration. There's a really simple fix to this, and I don't know why the Conservatives don't do it. It's when you go onto the, log onto the website, yes, I'd like to apply for a visa, please. And you get a little page saying, I'm sorry, we're not accepting applications for visas at this time. Please try again next year. And then next year comes, oh, I'm sorry, we're not accepting applications for visas. And we just, for 20 years, don't accept applications for visas. 20 years of 170,000 net outflow, that's going to help. That's going to change a lot of things in our favor, the British public's favor, and not for the favor of, you know, people living everywhere else in the world. You know, they don't have a right to come here. We're not obligated to host them, and we don't have to, and we shouldn't.
It's bonkers. I find it crazy that we left Afghanistan after being involved in Afghanistan, what, first 200 years ago, we left because the mess. And then we say, but don't worry, we'll bring you all to the UK. So leave it as a mess there. Don't bring it over here and make this country a mess.
Hang on. We know how this is going to end, you know. Not well.
Oh, let me try and bring Carl back.
Sorry, my I don't know why my internet's having a funny evening. Normally it's brilliant.
Carl, let's just two minutes. I just want to just touch on it's a bigger question, but just 2 or 3 minutes. Just the whole issue of again, individual liberty. Now, Boris has been much better than it could be worse. It could be worse. We could be in Australia or Canada or somewhere else that is completely authoritarian and using COVID as a reason to destroy all types of freedoms. Boris has not been as bad. So I guess we've got some, we can thank our lucky stars or whatever for that. But again, the Conservative Party, I think it was Priti Patel said, snitch on your neighbours, phone up the police. So it was still that, why is that thought even coming from someone who is a Conservative MP?
That's a great question. I mean, this is what I mean about like the instincts of Boris. Like he is a, you know, he knows the right thing to do. And it is ingrained in him, and he's just too weak to put his foot down and push the pedal, you know, and just do it. You know, he knew that all of this was bad. And you can tell the excessively apologetic way that he approached all of it as well. But I don't know. And, you know, people in the chat are saying, well, look, they're a globalist party. They're building back better. They're part of the Davos agenda, you know, with Joe Biden and all, you know, Canada, Trudeau, all the rest. And that's true. That's true. That's absolutely true. And I hope Boris sleeps well at night, because if I were him, I'd be racking myself. I wouldn't be able to sleep for a bloody second. But I don't know why. I don't know what they've got on them. I don't know why they've persuaded them, why they're forcing them to do this. It's obvious that the British public don't want that. I don't say this in any way to sound derogatory, because I embrace this label myself. The majority of the British public are little Englanders, little Scotlanders, little Welshers. You know, then I am a little Englander as well. You know, I don't want to go and conquer the world. I don't want an empire. I want to be able to manage my garden and send my kid to a nice school and have a good job and, you know, grow old and be happy and be merry and, you know, go out with my friends on a Friday night and things like that. You know, I don't want much out of life. And I think that's what really most of the country kind of feels like. You know, it's just everyone that I meet seems to have that general attitude towards life. And for some reason, they've got these big dreams of global empire still in their heads. It's got to stop. It's absolutely got to stop. Don't know why, though. Don't know why. If anyone's got any ideas, let me know.
On that, Carl, thank you so much for your time. It's a lot to talk about, and it's good to discuss on that. We do sometimes focus maybe too much on US politics because it's interesting. Biden is
important.
Trump is. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Trump's been doing great recently, though, hasn't he? Just going around, meeting people, having fun, and everyone's cheering him. And what are they doing to Biden? Boo, boo, wherever he goes, even in California, New York, and New Jersey, you know, places that Democrat strongholds, he's getting booed. And Trump goes to the New York Police Department. Look at him. They couldn't be more thrilled to see him. It's like, who's the legitimate king? Come on.
Yeah.
It's great. Bring to on watch. 2024. Let's see if they can fortify it as hard as last time.
It's great to watch. So we have just let you know our viewers. So we have, what are you coming up? So a news review with Atheist Steve, Speaker's Corner Steve. He'll be joining us on Saturday. And on Monday, I've got just over my car there. There's my Bitcoin, Future of Money. I've just finished reading by Dominic Frisby. Fantastic reading. It's an issue I've been looking into for the last 6-8 months. So Dominic's coming on Monday to discuss the whole area of Bitcoin. He wrote that book 2014, and it's mind-boggling to see how changes have happened since then. In 2014, talked about the cryptocurrency being worth, I think it was $3 billion. 3.5 billion. It's now worth 2.3 trillion. So that's in 7 years. Big changes. So tune in for Dominic on Monday. And if you people can just go to lotuseaters.com, can they, Carl, and get their ticket for Friday?
They can indeed, or you can go on YouTube and search for Podcast of the Lotus Eaters or any of our names. You should be able to find something. But yeah, lotuseaters.com is just where we are regularly, and I'm very proud of the content we produce. So if you want to go check that out, please feel free.
And on that, we'll wish our viewers or listeners a wonderful, if you're here live, a wonderful rest of your Thursday evening, and look forward to seeing you on Saturday. Please do, as I said, like and share. And if you don't get our weekly emails because you haven't subscribed, so go to heartsofoak.org and click on that connect button, stick in your email address, and you'll get a weekly email. So it's one way of keeping in touch. Emails are not censored as yet, so do jump onto that. Go back to good old email. You never know what happens to social media, so we can keep in touch with you, whatever happens on the social media side. So on that, I'll just thank you, Carl, and thank you to our viewers, and we'll see you on Saturday.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.